What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It's been 793 days since October 7th, 2023. In that time, Israel has murdered 70,354 Palestinians, wounded 171,030 others. At least 367 Palestinians have been murdered in Israeli attacks on Gaza since the first full day of the so-called peace plan that began on October 11th. Israel continues to refuse aid trucks entry to Palestine, and over 600 Palestinians have died of starvation, including more than 200 children. We know these numbers are an undercount. The death toll has been continuously rising since the onset of phase one of Trump's plan as bodies are recovered from rubble and Israel refuses to stop bombing. Joining us to discuss recent events, headlines, and analysis is Hatem Bazian, a Palestinian-American academic and activist. He's a teaching professor in the departments of Near Eastern and Asian American and Asian Diaspora Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-founder and professor of Islamic Law and Theology at Zaytuna College, the first accredited Muslim liberal arts college in the United States. Good morning, Hatem. Thank you for joining.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to have you. I've wanted to have you since we were at the CARE San Francisco event together. My guy's a big fan. Hatem, you here, and I'm sure you're tracking the numbers, right? Because it's what you do. Watching at first, you know, October 11th, Israel's bombing tapered down. It never stopped. It did taper when the ceasefire was announced, and then began to escalate again with no consequences. No surprises there for you. I imagine that we're sort of on repeat from the first so-called ceasefire, yes?
Well, the numbers, actually, if we remember June 2024, the Lancet magazine, you know, highly respected medical magazine, estimated the numbers of death at 183,000 or 186,000. And that's June 2026. And they take the calculation that for each direct death by immediate bombing or attack, usually a four other death that occurs. And therefore, they made the calculation, which is usually used for any conflict in terms of arriving at the casualties for a war. So we're looking really in terms of the figures for actual deaths from Israel genocide in Gaza is close to 400,000. Because the Gaza Ministry of Health only records those individuals that arrive to a hospital, to a recording place, and there are many that have completely been evaporated, their bodies completely been decimated as a result of the bombing that took place. So that just on terms of the numbers, and we're not going to be able to actually get the full figures until a full investigation by the International Criminal Court or any of the UN agency. Don't hold your breath. I'm not expecting much from the UN, but that's the reality. As far as the ceasefire, this is literally masquerading as a ceasefire because Israel was given and continued to have a free hand of operation, of bombing, of attacks, of starvation. So all the same policies that have been in place prior to the ceasefire are still in there. Only the intensity of the bombings and the attacks are not there. And then if we switch a little bit to the West Bank, it's a full-on season of a ongoing, slow, completely uncovered, silent ethnic cleansing and genocide taking place in the West Bank with a full annexation of Area C and emptying of Area B that is occurring in front of our eyes with settlers protected by the Israeli army operating nonstop all across the West Bank. So that's the notion of a ceasefire or the peace plan that is being offered and is on the table.
Well, and we're going to get, I'm hoping that we're going to get to spend some time on the West Bank a little bit later, because I feel like it does continuously get overshadowed what is happening there, and that's somewhat intentional. But I want just to be clear, and maybe I'm missing something. The West Bank isn't included or mentioned in any of these 20-point plans. Right? We're just talking about Gaza.
We're talking about Gaza, and the West Bank is literally unaddressed, and the Israeli Knesset have already voted on an annexation plan for the West Bank, and our ambassador in there, Huckabee, Mike Huckabee, who's basically searching up and down Palestine, searching if Jesus is coming, the second coming, and implementing his evangelical worldview, which indicating that he wants a full annexation of the West Bank and dismisses the notions of Palestinians or the notions of anything resembling Palestinian self-determination in Palestine.
That actually leads me somewhere I wasn't going to go, but I think you are uniquely poised to answer. Talk to me and my listeners about the connection between Christian evangelical missions, belief systems, and Zionism. What is the alignment there?
Well, I think what we need to use the term is Christian Zionism. Christian Zionism predates Jewish Zionism, which was very interesting because even if we go back as far as Columbus, the famous Columbus that people still celebrate, Columbus in his diaries in the Caribbean wrote in 1492, I think December 2nd, 1492, saying that his mission to cross the Atlantic was in essence to launch a new crusade by coming to the Muslim world from the east by crossing and arriving in India. That's the whole notion of saying arriving in India and striking an alliance with the Khan of China, a pro-Christian monarch, and then launching a crusade from the east to recapture Jerusalem and usher the second coming of Jesus. So that's Columbus in terms of why he crossed the Atlantic to find an alternative route to India. People think that he only was looking, searching for spices. Again, spices are always needed for European food, it's bland. But that the notion of trying to seek an alternative route was to search for spices, gold, silver, in order to use it for launching a crusade. So if you take this, it appears again during Napoleon's campaign on Egypt, where he was also thinking and writing about a millenarian end of time scenario. And then some of the theologians in the mid 1800s, European Christian theologians, writing about this. Now, it's only in the late part of the 19th century that Jews in Europe, in particular Herzl and some of the secular Jews, that adopt Zionism and begin to write about Zionism from their deep pain of feeling and having anti-Semitism in Europe. And they begin to adopt it. But the Christian Zionism continued to grow. It migrated or been implanted in the United States, and the evangelical population in the US is literally squarely focused on supporting Jewish Zionism as a stepping stone for the second coming of Jesus. And that's where you see the evangelical interest in Israel, not because all of a sudden they fell in love with the Jewish person and Judaism. In essence, they see it in a utilitarian function, playing end of time worldview, beating the drums of war, because it seems that Jesus is sitting in there waiting for an F-16 to be delivered to the region. And once death and destruction comes, that he'll appear to be, quote, the Prince of Peace. But the Prince of Peace or the Prophet of Peace will literally, from the evangelicals, will kill two-thirds of the Jewish population and one-third will convert to Christianity. And then the Muslim world will have to go to destruction because they don't actually are included in this conversion end-of-time worldview. So it's a very sinister type of articulation. Interestingly enough, Christians, Palestinian Christians, don't adhere to this notion of Christian Zionism. And as far as I know, this is some of the oldest Christian populations in the world, in Palestine, in Egypt, in Syria, Lebanon, and so on. So this evangelical Christian Zionism literally is a worldview, originates from Western Christianity, accepting exceptionalism, this exceptionalist history, and locating this notion of the second coming within the trajectory of Western civilization. Now, interestingly enough, this notion of Christian Zionism begins to give credence to militarism, to intervention, to war, because we're all doing it to bring God back. So in this sense, God once again is utilized or deployed as a way to authorize and give support for empire and its footprint across the world. So in my work on what I call the seven aspects of colonial history or colonization, Christianity was a handmaiden to militarism, to capitalism, to genocide, to racism, to manifest destiny, to epistemological notion. And that's what we're dealing when we're speaking about Christian Zionism, which is a far more powerful force than Jewish Zionism, even though they appear partners in this enterprise.
I feel like what I'm going to say next is going to sound really simple.
Sure.
But I'm assuming Jewish Zionists understand that Christian Zionists ultimately want to see the destruction, demise completely of Jewish people. Yes?
Oh, yes. But again, it's a marriage of convenience. And if you told somebody in the 1800s that this will be the case in terms of Jewish populations' alliance with the Christian populations within the framework of Christian Zionism and Jewish Zionism, they would say it's a shotgun wedding. But this is what it is. Zionists in Israel and Zionism across the world, they understand it's a marriage of convenience. And they say, we'll take the support right now. And when Jesus comes, we'll deal with it. That type of, understanding.
I mean, I get it. I feel it. On the left, we say a good organizer knows there's no permanent enemies. There's no permanent friends, right? You figure out who you can align with. You're not supposed to sell your soul, though, in that alignment. But
Yeah.
Apples, oranges, I guess. Okay, back to some of the news headlines, right? So we started off really talking about there really has been no phase one. There has been some exchange of hostages, some exchange of bodies, but there has been no ceasing of bombing. So help me understand why I'm seeing headlines that the plan is moving to phase two, because it seems like we never did phase one. And this is something even Netanyahu was saying.
Well, again, I think in here what we're facing is propaganda and information that's being put out, especially by mainstream news sources that continue to really reflect Israeli communication press releases and U.S. communication press releases. So phase one is still has not been implemented. There's been no ceasefire from Israel. It's been from day one, constant attack. Food supplies have not been coming in, and even the few or the limited supplies that are coming in do not meet the immediate needs. Then the notions of this international, which was moving to the phase two, this international stabilization force. There's discussions about who will be the members of this stabilization force? What are their credentials? More importantly, what is their authority? Because this is not a peacekeeping force, which is a very distinct in relations to the United Nations infrastructure. Peacekeeping force, which would be coming in without the authorization to use lethal force against the populations or against the combatants from both sides. Their notion is to sit and set up an infrastructure between the two camps that are fighting. But this is a stabilization force with the authority to use lethal force, lethal weapons against, in particular, the Palestinians. And then added to it is this notion of disarming the Palestinians and the non-governmental forces that are in Palestine. So here, just it's an absurdity, but let's go through it. Again,
Thanks.
The world these days just gives us so much. Here's a population that has been committed to genocide for almost 2.5 years right now. Almost 80 to 85% of all of Gaza has been destroyed. Israel has used every lethal weapon under its disposal, and yet the stabilization force is not coming to protect the Palestinians, but actually to act as an agent of Israeli security apparatus to do what Israel has not been able to accomplish in its genocide against the Palestinians, was in essence to try to disarm the Palestinians. And so there is this in terms of what is the authorization, what is the scope of responsibility. So both the United States and Israel want this force to come in and literally do the dirty job once again, and to give the international cover for a continuation of the genocide by other means. The other means will be this international force. Israel now is objecting to the makeup of this stabilization force, problematic as it is. They don't want Turkey to participate. They don't want certain countries because they feel that they might be closer to the Palestinians, meaning that they will not shoot first and ask questions later. They might not see the Palestinians as the perpetrator, and therefore they would possibly maybe extend some level of protection. So there's a haggling right now about the countries to participate, and Israel is refusing certain countries in there, and they want to handpick. I wouldn't be surprised if they would actually insist on a whole host of mercenaries that would be recruited, i.e. Blackwater or Khaki, which is the mercenaries that we saw their deployment during the Katrina floods in New Orleans when they were deployed. They were deployed in Iraq, and they might be actually used. And there is definitely information about their recruitment in there. So that's on the stabilization force. The second, with the UN Security Council resolution, it created the Board of Peace. So now we could actually say officially in Palestine, we actually celebrate, jokingly, that Trump now is the king in Gaza, because he actually was appointed as the chair of the Board of Peace with wide-ranging authority, with a number of international members, which, we thought Resolution 181 in 1947 was horrific, all right? But this actually, the UN Security Council resolution that was passed by Security Council literally delivered Gaza to the United States, to Trump, and we actually have included Tony Blair. He will be actually also included, and a few other so-called international representative to select a bureaucratic number of Palestinian bureaucrats to run the affair of Gaza. This is not even a mandate or protectorate status. It's even worse than possibly the configuration. What is sad about this is that a number of Arab countries and Muslim countries that were in the discussion for the Security Council lined up with the United States, including the Palestinian Authority, and opposing the Russian resolution or Russian offer, and that's how the Security Council resolution has passed. So the problems are so many and so deep in relations to what is taking place right now on in relations to Gaza, and how they're really attempting to bypass and subvert the Palestinians' call for self-determination, their right to independence, their right to run their own affairs. So literally it's delaying and pushing and subverting all these rights only to serve Israel and U.S. interests in the region.
Martin Bazin, I've got a lot of follow-up questions to what you just said, so I'm just going to walk through them in no particular order. So I think that the first one, I'm going to try to stair-step as you did. You spoke about, Israel's not happy with some of the folks at the other countries to make up the stabilization board. Is it laid out anywhere? And let me just preface, every question that I ask about the rules, I am very clear that the rules don't matter. I just have to put it in that framework so people get it, right? So is it laid out anywhere in the plan? I don't remember seeing it, but how the board of stabilization is supposed to be chosen, meaning does Israel have right of refusal, like a jury pool, for instance?
Well, the details of the stabilization force are not detailed or worked out. It is still to be negotiated It's almost the Trump 18 points plan that was put forth. Literally, you're talking about maybe it's somebody that went to ChatGPT and developed a PowerPoint, and that's what the plan. So there is no details worked out. Israel does insist that it has the right of refusal, and I would expect that it's this right or this assertive of power will be put to the test. And I don't think that the Trump administration will take Israel to task, considering that that Israel's support within Congress and Senate and so on could be brought to bear. And I don't think the details are there or how this stabilization force is to actually carry its mandate. There isn't any clear instructions or diktats of how and when and by which mechanism decisions to use force is to be articulated. And considering now we have a major debate on Pete Hegseth saying kill them all, fog of war, all this, and this is in a place where we have a command and control structure, we have a government in full operation, and we're seeing what's taking place in Venezuela, where the United States is acting this way. So how is this stabilization force going to operate? Who has the command and control structure? Who will make the decisions to use force and not to use force? Which countries' command structures will actually have a veto power? So assuming, let's say, for example, we have six countries or seven countries that are sending troops. Is the United States going to be the command and control structure? Is the Turkish forces, is the Qatari forces, the Pakistanis, the Moroccans, the Germans, the Italians, Spanish, which command structure? NATO? And assuming you have seven or eight that are there, who decides who's going to go to Gaza City and say, you are responsible to disarm this group of Palestinians? By which authority do you have in an occupied area to actually go against the indigenous population in there and to say that I've been authorized by the UN Security Council that have created the debacle itself from 1947 to actually engage? So there's so many questions about this, assuming that all the participating forces, and again, I'm assuming, considering that possibly we're between Saturday Night Live and Comedy Central discussing this, assuming that it functions, right, and they're coming for the best interests of the Palestinians, all these questions are literally have no answers, no specifics, and they're going to continue to have this possibility of almost a disaster unfolding in front of our eyes in the middle of a genocide.
I mean, not for nothing, but along the lines of what you just said about between Saturday Night Live and Comedy Central, as you were talking, I was trying to think of the last time a coalition of countries, militaries, got together and went into a country that was not their own on a peacekeeping mission, and how much peace was actually achieved, right? Not so much. You can't
Well,
get peace with violence.
interestingly, the last such a structure that has been put in formation was the Rwandan genocide and the Bosnian genocide. And in both cases, the genocide has already occurred. Western countries were implicated in the genocide. The Rwandan genocide, again, they continued to be dealing with the diamonds and whether it's the Netherlands or France and so on. And we're still pursuing there are still legal cases pending on the complicity of Western countries and Western elites in the Rwandan genocide. In the Bosnian genocide as well, the UN forces itself that were appointed or given the authority to be a peacekeeping force, they actually were complicit in allowing the genocide, especially the massacre in Srebrenica, which killed over 8,000 in a systematic way. The UN forces were complicit in allowing the Serbs to actually engage in this genocide. So we have two cases in here that the UN peacekeeping force, not stabilization force, because again, there's a world of difference between these stabilization force that have been given for the first time lethal, the use of lethal force to disarm a combatant group versus the peacekeeping force. And I think that's where we're dealing with this in terms of a major, major crisis in relations to how Palestine and Gaza are to be managed, for no other reason than to protect and extend Israeli genocide and give them international cover under the guise of the United States plan.
For those of you just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. This is Palestine Post, because it's Monday, and I'm in conversation with Palestinian-American academic and activist Hatem Bazian. Hatem, in addition to the stabilization, the border stabilization, being a means to the end, literally, right, finishing the genocide, and I understand that the two are linked, but I wonder if you can say more about it. It's also a pathway to the development, that's an air quote for those of you not watching on YouTube, the development of Gaza. Trump, we all saw the god-awful AI video, and people guffawed at it, but that's kind of what dude does, right? He goes into places and he builds these atrocities, now, you know, usually in cities or whatever, but not like a whole country.
Yeah, well, I think we're dealing, there are three components. One is the stabilization force. The second is the Board of Peace, which is to be chaired by King Trump and with war criminal Tony Blair in relations to the war in Iraq, and then another board members. And then the third is a Palestinian hand-selected bureaucratic group that will actually run the day-to-day affairs. Within that, the so-called development plan, where donors or countries will participate. So far, the plans for development is only to occur in what's called the yellow line that has been set up, where Israel actually almost carved out a large swath of Gaza that will be subject to the development, where the area where the Palestinians on the western side of this line will not be subject to the development. We know from early on that Trump wanted to create a Riviera, right? It's a real estate deal. Kushner is involved in it and a whole bunch of other people. So they're looking at it as a real estate deal. Second to this real estate deal is what we need to understand. There is a competition, if not all out thievery and pillaging that is being planned for Gaza's natural gas that's offshore. So there's a massive gas field offshore of Gaza. And this development is included in relations to this massive gas field. So that's where there's the intense interest to try to have access and put the called international community hands on the natural gas. And in particular, the European countries, Germany and others, they would like to have access to this natural gas and to develop it for a pipeline to replace the dependency on Russian pipeline. So this notion on this structure that is being thought out, central to it is, again, silencing, bypassing, completely pushing aside the Palestinians to make a decision on their own, in their own land, over their own property, their own territory, and so on. So this Trump peace plan is not a peace plan. It's literally a real estate natural gas deal by individuals and players, international players, that are committed to pillage wherever you can, steal whenever it's possible, and give international colonial legalism. I call it a colonial legalism that is taking place, where you give this international cover for outright pillaging and thievery of resources and territories. And it's not, again, I don't want to say Palestine is unique, because if anybody looked at the history over the past 500 plus years, if we think about what's taking place in Sudan now, the richness, the resources, we think about the Congo, one of the most rich territories in the world. It happens to have diamonds, oil, natural resources, right? So whenever we have conflicts in the global south, it is a conflict that often is framed as cultural, ethnic, religious conflicts, but at the core of it is the resources that are there and using all kinds of instrumentalization to steal, rob, and pillage these raw material to be directed to the global north. I hope that people who are listening don't believe for a minute that we're attacking boats off the shore of Venezuela, because all of a sudden these small boats are drug smuggling to the United States, or the cause of our drug problem, whether it's fentanyl or opioid. If you want to know where the problem of drugs in the United States, go no further than the pharmaceutical companies, go no further than the Sackler family, go no further than Walgreens, all of the Walmart. All of these were held responsible for pushing opioid on the American public for year in, year out. And then whenever they get caught, they literally are slap on the hand. You pay a fine, $500 million, or even the Sackler family, right, paid or at least been charged with pushing opioid for a long period of time. Then the family actually transferred its wealth into another bank account and then filed for bankruptcy to protect themselves. But this, again, anyone that studies the history of the United States says racial discourse uses drugs as a signpost for race, use crime as a signpost for race, use immigration or controlling immigration as a signpost for race, and that's what we are using. So the discussions about what has taken place in Gaza is the same settler colonial slash colonialism that has taken place, that have a new lease on life and being given another layer of international stamp of legitimacy, making that which is illegitimate legitimate by means of these deliberations.
Real quick digression, because it's a passion of mine for folks that want to learn more about what Hatem was talking about in terms of the Sackler family and the complicity of Walgreens, Walmart, etc. Dope Sick. It's a Netflix film. I think it does the best layout of it. That's not an actual documentary, but that's where I would go to learn if you're new to the subject. All right, Hatem, two of the guarantors of the ceasefire, Egypt and Qatar, are demanding Israel fully withdraw from Gaza and for the stabilization force to be deployed. Qatar's prime minister says there's been a pause. He at least says there's been a pause, but we cannot consider the ceasefire. Right on, thanks. Now, you and I know. We know, my listeners know at this point, who tune in and have the last 2.5 years, that Israel's not pulling out of anything. Not only that, the Rafah crossing, right, they opened it, but only some Palestinians can leave. Nobody can come back. I've asked this question of a lot of my guests, right, because to me, what this says, right, this is performative, because neither Egypt, who has been complicit in a lot of the tragedy that we're watching Palestinians live through, particularly those in Gaza, they're not going to do anything. But they're not going to go in there and force Israel to get out. What is the point of the performance, and what does it matter that they're making these demands?
Well, we have to understand that the not only the Arab and Muslim world, but the global population are increasingly and strongly on the side of the Palestinians. So Egypt's population, which has had a long history of continued support and solidarity with the Palestinians, including actually being in the front line as a population in expressing solidarity with the Palestinians, and I would say is the norm across the Arab and Muslim world and across the global south and increasingly in the global north. So they have to engage at one level or the other in this performative objections and give a nod to their population that we are holding on the lines and holding true to supporting the Palestinians, while in reality, they have been constantly coordinating, not only neutral, coordinating their steps, their move, their apparatus with Israel. At least from early on, the Egyptian intelligence advised Israel of how to handle entry into Gaza, and they would actually give them some pearl of wisdom that of how to manage their relationship in there. The second part is that Egypt does receive a considerable support from the United States in terms of foreign aid. And they are to coordinate and maintain their relationship with Israel and protect and provide security in the region for Israel and cooperation. So the objections, right, in here are to manage the conflict from the U.S. and Israel's perspective rather than to actually alter or change the landscape. Egypt is a sovereign state. It has a full responsibility of its side of the border in terms of Rafah. If Egypt wants to open Rafah, they would have the full responsibility. And Israel violated the articles of the Camp David Agreement, which was signed between Egypt and Israel, in the sense that Israel have entered its forces, completely bombed and dismantled the Rafah military zone that was set up, and also attacked Egyptian forces on the Rafah side. So this is literally a performative political theater intended to placate the mass expression of solidarity that is visible across the Arab and Muslim world by indicating that we're standing with Palestine. For Arab and Muslim populations specifically, the notion that Arab countries acting as mediators and in neutral mediators in a settler colonial regime is an insult to the basic intelligence of the history and legacy of both the Arab and Muslim world and the history and legacy of what does it mean to be in a global South orientation vis-a-vis a European settler colony that is supported by the ex or the former settler colonial states in the West, with the United States, Western Europe, and so on. So when some states right now saying that we are trying to negotiate as a neutral mediators, this actually is unprecedented, both historically and also in terms of the legacy of Palestine as a central focal point in the discourse of the Arab and Muslim world, let alone the history of global South resistance for colonization. Just to get you to the sense that the country that took the case of the Palestinians to the international court, the criminal court, is South Africa, which is very, very interesting and also illustrative. South Africa is the last settler colony in Africa to be completely freed when Nelson Mandela went out of jail in 1991. That was not only coming out of Robben Island himself, it was the death of settler colonial infrastructure in Africa, which lasted so many years, right? Africa, north, south, east, west, with the exception of a small area in Liberia and a small area in Ethiopia, was completely colonized. You were a colony of the Dutch, the British, the French, the Belgian, the Italian, Spanish, and so on. So South Africa, to take this case, is still reflecting the global South epistemology of actually trying to bring end to settler colonialism, which means the Arab and Muslim world is still functioning within the settler colonial motherland colony orientation, and they are trying to give a new lease in life into a dying colonialism per Fanon's statement. So that's what we need to think about when what Egypt is doing, what Qatar is doing, what Arab and Muslim states are doing. They literally are giving a new lease of life to colonization by not actually standing and saying that this cannot go. And Israel genocide would not been possible, and this is very important, would not been possible without the complicity of Arab and Muslim states in the current. I'm leaving the West aside, not because they're innocent, but all the surrounding countries made it possible for Israel to carry its genocide. And not only that, they provided the resources for the continuation of the genocide of Israel over the past 2.5 years.
I want to talk a little bit about this yellow line, the one that keeps moving. which Israel recently stated, right, it's the new border. But no one except for Israel really can say where it is. Israel keeps utilizing it as a justification for killing people who cross this thing that nobody can see. You mentioned it as a dividing factor where development will or will not take place. I just want to give you a few minutes to talk about this yellow line, this new parameter, border, if you will, of colonization and genocide.
Well, I put this this part of the shifting borders within the idea and the structure of colonization, right? And in particular, settler colonization. Settler colonization and colonization in general often engages in shaping the geography, right? In the United States, we understand you put what you call an outpost and you create what you call boundaries around it. And now that is the new extension of where the border stands. I think our indigenous brothers and sisters in the Americas understand how that history developed. So colonization creates the geography, changes the topography, changes the borders, and moves this line. And with it also the racial classification that takes place, dividing people into different segments. And Israel has constantly been doing this. So this new yellow line will be created and or is currently created to be a new place or a new line where the negotiations has to be or is to engage. Israel always creates what's called facts on the ground. You create a fact, and now the negotiations will center around whether this is a fact, this is legitimate or illegitimate, and so on. By the time you actually end up trying to arrive at an understanding, a new fact on the ground has been created, right? So the process is that the yellow line now becomes the basis of negotiations, and Israel possibly will agree, will withdraw maybe 2 miles in or 2 miles out, will extend 2 miles to the north, 2 miles. All of this is rechanging the geography, the topography, and the structure of the Gaza. And the international community, rather than saying cease and desist, immediate withdrawal, not only of the Gaza, but all of the West Bank, begin to actually give legitimacy to the colonial geography that is being created and shaping the various layered occupations, various layered colonization that Israel has undertaken with the Palestinians. Now, the reason that this happens is that the international community, don't laugh, quote, is very well accustomed to this reality because that's how they function, right? Meaning that they understand they are operating from the same worldview. The same worldview that brought us the destruction and colonization of Africa, Latin America, the bombings right now that is taking place in Venezuela, the invasion of Iraq, all this is coming from the same worldview. So Israel, in essence, is part of the country club, is not outside the country club. So when Israel creates a new border, the yellow line, the new settlements, the security zone, the security structure, they are operating within a coherent, illegitimate, but coherent, and represents this notions of the international order that is actually, as you show, disorder, because colonization is the structure of the underdevelopment and suppression of the rights of people across the world, and we're here dealing with Palestine and Gaza. So the yellow line is literally a colonial geography unfolding in front of our eyes, supported and given credence. So the fact that somebody stands up right now and we're having to discuss a yellow line rather than the illegitimacy of occupation, the illegitimacy of settler colonization, the illegitimacy and literally war crimes and genocide, we begin to actually talk about the yellow line as if it is the yellow bus taking kids back and forth. That's the absurdity. Again, I say it's absurdity, but that's where we are because the international order that we are operating is an absurd order set up by the powerful colonial powers that still operate in the post-colonial order, and they give themselves rights that are literally illegitimate, illegal, but they operate that power makes right rather than actually justice and human rights makes rights. That's where we are.
Thank you. That is exactly what the conversation I was looking to have. We've got just about 5 minutes left together, Hatem, and so I do want to take some time to talk about the escalation that's been moving for months in the West Bank, the continuing violent raids, both by the IDF, but also in IOF, but also by settlers, and the tag teaming that's happening. Talk about, and this is also right, so over the weekend there was an uptick in violence, and Israeli media reported that the finance minister, Smotrich, has set aside approximately more than $830 million to fund, you were talking about the annexation announcements, $830 million to fund 17 new settlements over the next 5 years. This is illegal. I mean, not that Israel cares. I know. That's why I said, I know the rules don't matter, but I still have to say, you're not allowed to, like, technically, they're supposed to be doing this. Tied into to your commentary about what's happening in the West Bank, I'm wondering if also you could talk about, which I guess is also performative, but Trump saying to Israel, you will not do this in the West Bank, as well as the UAE saying, you won't do this in the West Bank. Why?
Well, again, this is another element of a performative. They have to give the impression that there is a concern for the Palestinians and that there is a concern for the international order. Again, I no longer hold my breath with listening to these statements, because if you want Israel to stop, then you have to bring an end to this carte blanche military support. You could bring a carte blanche for the funding that goes out. You could actually say, anytime you spend a penny on a settlement, that will be actually freezing your assets in the United States or Europe or even in the Arab world. Again, Israel has massive investments in Jordan, in United Arab Emirates, in Turkey, in Bangladesh, in Morocco, Mauritania, you name it, or Egypt. So if we are serious, right, that you will not do this, whether it's Trump or these countries, then put what you call force to your statements. We know exactly that. And again, I want to add Jordan as well into the mix, so somebody will not say that they left somebody out. So this is performative. This is basically don't do it so much that we get embarrassed that we have to answer, you know, to some questions that are coming our way, and deniability under international order to say that we actually said to Israel not to do it. But wink, wink, continue, we're going to continue funding. You know, you have actually, in the United States, there are actually real estate agencies that host Israeli settlers that come and sell properties in settlements. And they host these, what you call property sales, whether in LA, New Jersey, New York, other places. So if the United States or Trump is serious by saying you are not going to do this, then individuals that are coming to the United States to sell illegal properties should be held to the law, meaning that they are selling an illegal property and also participating in violation of the international law for Geneva Convention and so on. But again, I no longer hold my breath because, again, we violated every piece or every article of the Fourth Geneva Convention in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Abu Ghraib, and you name it. So that's why I say it's performative and allowing Israeli settlers, allowing the Israeli government, Smotrich, Ben-Gavir, and others to continue to massively expand the footprint of the settlements and the settlers in the West Bank, while focus is on Gaza, rightly so, for the genocide. Israel has already doubled its land settlement acquisitions of the West Bank and completely almost took over all of Area C and expanding its footprint on Area B. So while we're trying to negotiate for a pizza in Gaza, the settlers and the Israeli government are devouring all the flowers and all the pizza production that has taken place. And the international community and the Arab world say, oh, stop, stop. You know, we're concerned. That just does not cut it.
Hatem, I'm going to have you back to spend a whole hour on the West Bank. For now, I have to thank you so much for giving me an hour of your very valuable time and joining me this morning.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.